From New York City, this is Film Spotting, Streaming Video Unit. I am Allison Wilmore.
And I'm David Sims, filling in for Matt Singer, who's off on paternity leave.
Pleasure to have you here.
So happy to be here.
David is, as I'm sure most of you already know, a film critic at The Atlantic, and he also has his own podcast, Blank Check, which we were just talking about, mm-hmm. and which he co-hosts with Griffin Newman, rising Hollywood star.
Renowned
Griffin,
actor.
Yes, Griffin Newman. And since he has been kind enough to donate his time here, I turned the main review wide open for him and said, choose anything, as long as it's streaming. We'll discuss. And David, you chose.
I chose Noah Baumbach's new Netflix original movie, The Meyerowitz Stories. Brackets, new and selected.
God,
I don't know about that.
So
I look, it's the Meyerowitz stories.
All right, yes. So this is Baumbach's first movie for the streaming service, starring Adam Sandler, Ben Stiller, Elizabeth Marvel, as the three children of Harold Meyerowitz, played by Dustin Hoffman, and inspired by the film's depiction of the complicated relationship between Sandler and Stiller's characters. We'll also be offering some streaming recommendations of other movies about what happens when brothers grow up.
Mm-hmm. First, let's talk Meyerowitz.
Are you Harold Meyerowitz's son, Matthew?
Yes. And this is Danny, also Harold Meyerowitz's son.
I didn't realize he had two sons.
And a daughter.
Dad, you'll be okay here?
It'll be nice to spend time with Dad. You know, I didn't get a lot of time with him growing up.
Son of a bitch!
So usually here on Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit, we let you vote on what we're going to talk about for our main review. We come up with some titles, we post a poll online, sometimes it's a close race, sometimes it's no race at all. But you know, since Matt's away, if thrown those rules in the air, chaos reigns. I'll turn the choice over to Mr. Sims here, who chose the Meyerowitz stories. We're going to drop the new and selected.
Yeah, no, let's dispense with the brackets, yes.
So this is the first film that Baumbach has made for Netflix, which has been expanding its original movies in exciting and some terrifying ways.
Very terrifying.
Like 80 movies next year they're slated to pay for.
Yeah, but they said that, but then aren't there like kids movies or other like maybe foreign acquisitions wrapped up in that? There's no way they're making 80 movies, right?
I just like, you know, when you look at the amount of money they're spending... Mm. It's inspiring in some ways. So you're like, they're paying for content. They're paying for films. They're maybe single-handedly funding cinema, but also...
Yeah, I'm not like, inspired.
No. Like, how is it possible?
it's more, I mean, not to diss Netflix too hard right off the top of the podcast, but it's kind of like someone at Wall Street making like really hostile acquisitions. You know, there's just something so... I don't know, aggressive about the way they're spending, where it just feels like it's a statement, and at some point the statement will no longer be required, and maybe then that's when the funding starts going down.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
That. No, I can definitely see that. I mean, especially, you know, like Meyerowitz Stories, Baumbach's first film for Netflix, this definitely is a statement film. This is them being like, we're going to make a movie that's going to play at the Cannes Film Festival.
Yeah.
And we're going to try and get awards with it.
Sure.
It's one of a few movies that I think they're kind of hoping might be an awards contender this year.
Yep.
But they also gave it the kind of confusing day and date theatrical and streaming release that they've been doing for these movies that they think merit or require a theatrical release.
I think they kind of whiffed the theatrical release. I guess, but I guess it doesn't matter. I don't know. Like... Don't you think so?
Oh,
like,
sure. I don't think that people maybe even knew that it was in theaters. They
right.
kind of like burp it out into theaters while at the same time then they splash it in the Netflix homepage, and that's what you get.
That's what you get. I mean, have you heard Baumbach talking about this in interviews? He's not happy.
I haven't, but it doesn't surprise me that he's not happy.
He's very, because every interview, obviously, you know, they talk about the movie, but then at the end, the interviewer will be like, and I have to ask, you know, you have a Netflix movie. How do you feel about Netflix? And he's basically like, bad for cinema, you know, like not happy.
Yeah,
which is interesting.
Well, he's a kind of old school type, as
he
I think
is.
this movie makes clear. It is a kind of old school New York story, but
yes.
that he seems like the kind of person who would have trouble letting go of the theatrical experience. And I think
this is shot on film, this movie. Mm-hmm. I think it's his first movie shot on film in a long time. Yeah.
And you know, it's funny that a movie that is kind of about a like is a like a throwback New York in some ways, or
very
like
much so.
That is not getting much of a New York release, probably.
I know it was like at the IFC Center for a week, I think. I don't know. I mean, look, the Netflix, we can have the Netflix conversation forever,
right?
you know, I think 2 years ago or a year ago, they did the thing where they had like 50 comedy specials. Remember that? Where like every week they had a comedy
special. They still are. I mean, I read a piece about how Netflix is almost in a weird way killing the joy of the comedy.
They are, because there's
no one wants it anymore.
Right. And it's also, they've had to, you know, dig further down, not to diss some of the comics who are getting these specials, but like, I'm not going to be as pumped about some of them as others, obviously. And right. And it's just like, that's just a tactic. They just decided, yep, saturation. That's what we're going to do. We'll see if that works. And it just feels like a lab experiment that, I don't know, may not be successful.
Right. You know. But in the meantime, it gave us this movie, as promised, the title, The Saga of the Meyerowitz Family.
Yep.
Patriarch Harold, played by Dustin Hoffman, a sculptor who is both in denial and acutely aware of the fact that he was never quite as big a deal career-wise as he has hoped.
Yes, he's a monologuer. He likes to monologue about his career in ways that are sort of, you know, both like, right, he's telling a tale that maybe isn't true about the arc of his career.
He's got a slippery sense of the truth.
Right.
he displays.
But he has some acknowledgement.
Right.
I
think it's clearly underneath there is a certain pain.
Yes.
Then he's got Danny, his oldest child, played by Adam Sandler, who's probably the actor who's gotten the most attention for this movie.
Yeah.
Danny is a failed musician turned house husband and father to aspiring filmmaker and college freshman Eliza, played by Grace Van Patten. Danny's also getting a divorce, which has kind of left him adrift at this particularly difficult moment in time. Then there's Jean, played by Elizabeth Marvel, who lives upstate. And there is Matthew, played by Ben Stiller, their half-brother.
Yep.
Harold has gone through several wives. Matthew lives in L.A. and has become a successful money manager. There's also Emma Thompson as Maureen, Harold's hippie alcoholic current wife. Then there are appearances from Candace Bergen, Rebecca Miller, Judge Hirsch, Adam Driver, many others.
Yeah, a lot of people pop up in this movie. Sigourney Weaver.
Sigourney Weaver as herself.
As herself.
A memorable cameo.
Yeah.
It's got a sprawling ensemble, but as you pointed out when you were choosing the topic we would talk about afterwards, it does really feel like a story of two brothers in particular.
Yep.
So I guess I wanted to ask you about that.
Okay.
Do you see this as a movie that is a legitimate portrait of a whole family, or do you mostly see it as like this portrait of two brothers and how they were both kind of shaped by this relationship with their sometimes withholding dad?
Often, I think, or at least with Adam Sandler's character more so. But yes, with both of them. Yes, I think it's a tale of the brothers, because as much as I adore Elizabeth Marvel as an actress, and I think she's really good in the movie and very funny, the movie pretty intentionally keeps her out of the picture. You know, she's always there, or often there. She's sort of hanging out. She has this big pivotal scene where she's basically like, I like being around you guys. But for his flaws or not, Baumbach has decided to make a movie about these two brothers that sort of has this like triptych format, where the first third is about the Adam Sandler character, then the second third is about Ben Stiller, which is weirdly my favorite part of the movie, even though it's like the kind of the least interesting part. But like, because I like how the Sandler portion is weeks at least, right? Like it's spanning time.
Right, yeah.
And then the Stiller portion is all one day. And then this third portion where they're sort of together and the dad has a medical incident and they're in the hospital, and you know, that's when the brothers are sort of like mixing it up. They're not even fighting, but then,
well, there is a
climactic fight. Right. But I mean, like, the movie's not about these two brothers who hate each other. Right. Like, he's not making Step Brothers.
No.
Right? Like, what's like
I wish he would.
Noah Baumbach's version of Step Brothers. I mean,
this sort of is his version of Step Brothers, though. It's about being related to someone and having shared history with someone, but also not necessarily liking them. Like, not that you wouldn't necessarily have chose to have a connection with this person.
They
but
have
you do.
A forced relationship, but they do have a lot in common. And it is about, you know, their father being the thing, obviously, that they mostly have in common. And it is about them figuring that out. But it's mostly about their relationships, independent relationships to their family, which, of course, you know, includes each other. But and them wrestling with the legacy of this guy who they are both kind of independently realizing is not that impressive. and was obviously so incredibly impressive to their development and to their everything, you know. And it's dawning on both of them, maybe, or maybe it dawned on them already a little bit, but still, like, they're sort of sitting in it that, like, their dad's old now and he's kind of doddering, and like, maybe he was never much of anything.
Right. And they have to be generous to him. They have to kind of indulge him.
They do. Yep. And again, these dynamics are so ingrained, and they have very different dynamics. Like, I can't keep forgetting. It's Matthew and what's Adam Sandler's name?
Danny.
Yeah, Danny and his dad are kind of like, you know, they're buds, kind of. They like watch the Mets.
But he's also the lesser son.
But he's so, yeah. It's like almost like Royal Tenenbaums-esque, where like
it's
he's just
very
like,
Royal Tenenbaums.
Like you're the first wife's son, and you're sort of, you know, fun to have around, you know. But like he's so openly disinterested in his like social status, I guess. I don't know. He's very disappointed in him. Right,
right.
I
mean, but also like relies on him to help around the house and
absolutely.
Like do errands. Yeah,
And then Matthew is the one where he's like, "Well, no, like the second wife, and I'm going to get this kid right." And he's so invested in Matthew's success, he's so happy that he makes money, but he's also obviously so unimpressed by him and has no idea who he is.
Yeah,
like no real comprehension of what he does, no comprehension of like what he likes. Like there's just no relationship.
Because like
there.
No one followed in his footsteps, also, which
and
he finds
no one
disappointing
followed, right,
in
right.
this funny way because. His footsteps aren't that grand.
They
you know,
aren't.
Like,
and of
yeah.
course, if someone had tried, he probably would have, you know, been tough to deal with in that regard as well.
Right.
And then he has this daughter who is, like, ignored by everybody.
Yeah. And I think, I suspect that I like this movie considerably less than you do.
Sure.
I don't dislike it, but
sure.
I'm very lukewarm on it. But the fact that she does not get a chapter really bothered me.
Yeah.
Especially
well,
when she gets like
she gets
an anecdote.
What's it like her story.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's like kind of spat out in a parking lot, a hospital parking lot.
I know. I'm not really gonna defend it. It's obviously intentional. It's not like
sure.
Noah Baumbach wrote the movie and was then
like
whoops. I forgot about that sister. I should include a whole no. I mean, you know, it's an interesting choice by him to do that.
Right.
Because the sister character is not functional to the movie. You don't need her at any point. She's,
no.
I mean, I really enjoy the performance. I think she's very good. But it's not like he could have just lifted the sister out. You
right.
know?
She has like gone off to have her own life far away.
Right.
It's like seems like a quiet but like totally fine
very
one.
Very functional
as much
life.
As it's explored at all, which it isn't really.
Right, because this like in this opening, not opening scene, but very early scene where they're all having dinner and... Harold is sort of obsessively talking about like, well, Danny's a failed musician and he's a house husband. He's sort of like talking through his son's career. And then they're all like, we don't even know what you do. And she's like, I work at Xerox. I'm like a
right.
project manager. You know, she has like a totally normal job in life.
Gene, you showed interest in photography.
I'm Montessori. Yeah. In my office at Xerox, I'm known as the resident auteur. I make funny movies for my coworkers' birthdays.
They're really good.
We have no idea what Gene does at Xerox. I'm a facilities manager for
when
special.
When was the last job you had, Danny?
And I guess that's just the that's the joke. And you just right, you didn't like the joke. I was
I just,
fine with
I
it.
I liked Elizabeth Marvel so much.
She's so good. When's
she's
she bad?
Really, I don't know, but she's so enjoyable in this, and I feel
she
like,
is.
I mean, my issue with this film is a lot. I mean, it is funny. It feels. It does feel a bit like the Royal Tenenbaums, which is an interesting, like, it's kind of this weird, like, unmistakable kind of quality with regard to the structure of the family and, like...
Yeah, right.
But it's also very much, like, it feels like an unofficial sequel to Squid and the Whale.
Yep, sure.
You know, Hoffman's character is very much like Jeff Daniels' character.
Mm-hmm.
I think he even uses some of the same... He uses elegant once. He says something is elegant. He has these kind of pretensions towards this, like, kind of New York intellectual life that... the life he's actually leading doesn't always reflect.
Yeah.
But I felt like this was really comfortable territory for Baumbach.
Right. But I'm fine with that.
But that's the thing is like,
let me just put on those slacks with a hummus stain.
Like he is someone I kind of get torn between either feeling like I really enjoy or that I find very tiresome. And like, mm-hmm. I think for me, the low point of that is like Margot at the Wedding, which is one of those movies where
it's
like, if like a UFO were to crash into this movie and kill all of the characters right now, I would be overjoyed. Yeah. I cannot stand these people.
Marco's tough. But what do you think of The Squid and the Whale? Because I don't like The Squid and the Whale either.
Like it that
much. I find that movie to be similar to Margot at the Wedding, where I just think it's too bleak and nasty, and like right. there's just nothing for me to really hold on to.
I feel exactly that way. Like I feel yeah. like
I think Jesse Eisenberg is really good in it because yeah. he is playing a kind of person that I know, you
yeah.
know, like, and we've all maybe recognized a little of it in ourselves or in other people we know or whatever. But I don't like that movie that much.
I don't like it. I appreciate the acting in it.
Yeah, it's well. Everyone's good in it.
Yeah,
yes,
but yeah. I think it also is one of those movies where I just struggle to find any kind of toehold. I feel like there is an assumption in some of his movies that you are on the same level as of some of these characters.
Right.
So he doesn't need to give you an in. But
right.
like with Squid and the Whale and with Margot, I'm just like, I don't like these people.
Yeah.
And I come a little close to that in this movie. I think it eventually lets you in.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of this movie where I'm just like, this is like being stuck next to a group of people you don't like at a restaurant, and like their conversation is drowning you out, and all you want to do is kind of leave. I'm just like, I don't want to spend time in proximity with these people.
Mm-hmm.
And then they kind of grew on me at the end.
Sure.
But I just needed more. I wanted him to stretch a bit more, and this felt like very comfortable.
Well, so I love Kicking and Screaming, which is, you know, that's a yeah. classic of the genre.
Absolutely.
And a great debut by him. But yeah, I was always sort of like, you know, that was the Baumbach movie I loved. Squid and the Whale, which was, I feel like, his big comeback, I was sort of indifferent to.
Francis Ha is my favorite.
Well, then he makes Greenberg, which is a remarkable movie, although
yes.
it is skin crawling.
Uh-huh.
But it is really good.
But it's intended to be skin crawling.
Yes, it is.
Which
it
I
is.
Feel like sometimes his movies aren't always.
No, for sure. That right. That movie is, I mean, also it has a really wonderful Greta Gerwig performance that yeah. is not skin crawling.
Right.
And then, yes, but then he makes these movies with Greta Gerwig, Francis Ha and Mistress America, that I adore. But then this year, we both saw Lady Bird.
Yes.
And of course, Gerwig co-wrote both of those movies with him. And Lady Bird is so great and has such spirit and like energy. And I was sort of thinking to myself, like, oh, is she sort of the magic ingredient?
Mm.
But then I see this movie and I really loved it. So like, I know. But so it made, like, one thing I didn't mind the comfort of it so much because I was almost happy to see him return to his comfort zone.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's also just this movie opens with Adam Sandler wearing a jacket with his daughter in the car trying to park, and like they're rambling at each other about, you know, should we go vegetarian, and like this is a good song on the radio, and
I put this on a tape for you when you were like 12.
Cool.
Was that a spot?
Yeah, he's taking it.
How did I miss that?
Go around.
We've been around. I'm going to go further east.
I love Adam Sandler when he's trying.
Yeah,
right?
Which is
you
not
know,
always,
once
especially
every
5 recently,
years,
it's
right.
not been the case much.
And I was so immediately connected to that character that I was in.
Yeah.
Where it seems like you needed some time.
I did. I think it's also just like, you know, this movie, Sandler's gotten a lot of talk for his performance in this.
He's so good.
And he is good. And
yeah.
Stiller's gotten some talk. He's also good,
he's
too.
He's actually excellent in a much more difficult role because
yeah.
it's like not... He doesn't have as much sort of like big sort
right.
of emoting
he's more
to do
closed.
Until
he's
the
like,
end.
Yeah, he keeps it all in.
Right.
But I think
he's a bottled up guy and he's kind of a jerk. But
yeah.
like not in an extreme way.
They're both kind of jerks though. I don't know. I think
yeah,
that,
yeah.
You know,
Sandler's
like,
a sad sack. But yeah,
he is. But he's also... I don't know. Like they're both variations on these personas that they like. It's funny because like these are both like, as comedic actors, they're both guys who like have rage bottled up, and
mm-hmm.
I feel like
mm-hmm.
you know, Sandler
yes,
is more like
course.
The kind of person who lets it out. He's
right.
a good
in
angry
ways,
man,
which is glorious watching him scream. Whereas
right.
like Stiller hasn't done that
like,
as much, but that was his 90s reputation.
That was it.
Mr.
It was
Furious
supposed to be like bottled up, right?
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And the Friends episode where he yells at the chick.
Right.
Do you remember that?
I do.
Sorry.
Well, I sort of do. I don't like. I was never a Friends watcher.
It's the he dates Rachel for a couple episodes and Ross is the only one who sees his rage.
Oh.
And so Ross keeps being like, no, this guy's crazy, and no one believes it. And then finally everyone watches him screaming at the chicken.
Ooh. Hey. Hey there, little fella. Mr. Fuzzy Man, how you doing? Oh. Ew. Oh. Ew. Gross. Idiot! Little fuzzy yellow creature! Oh, look at me, I'm so cute, I'm a little chick who's disgusting! stupid. How are you not yet extinct?
It is kind of, it deals with both of their on-screen like legacies a bit. Like, yeah, these characters are variations on those. And I feel like maybe Sandler, who I think is like, I gravitate more towards in this movie, but I think it's in part because you're like, it's really nice to see Adam Sandler like alive
again.
It's
nice to see him try. It's
yeah,
always
and engaged.
Nice to try.
You know,
and Netflix really has taken whatever of his soul remained and bottled it and put it in like deep in the ground.
Right,
so it's nice that they almost like get to do a Netflix movie that's not, you know.
Well, like so many of those movies.
Six,
yeah. Well, so many of those movies, it just feels like he shows up so that his friends can have work. And then he just stands in the middle of a movie that like swirls around him and that like he clearly does not care about.
No.
Yeah.
No. Like if I pointed a gun at him and said like, what's the name of your character in The Do-Over?
Mm.
He wouldn't know, right? I don't know. Maybe he would. Maybe,
I don't think he would.
I mean,
well, talk to me more about this movie. I want to hear like you love it from the beginning. Tell me, because it's also like, it is sort of episodic. It is
which yeah. I like yeah. episodic movies like this. But I mean, again, but I like his last non-Gerwig movie, While We're Young, was a non-episodic movie that was him trying to make this like structured movie with like a plot and a twist and
mm-hmm.
stuff. That movie's not great. It's not like the worst or anything. Like it's okay.
Yeah.
And like I'm more like this, where like the weird audaciousness of like a month episode and then a day episode and then like a year episode.
Yeah.
You know, because the hospital stay, like, I mean, I think part of what he's trying to say is, like, time has no meaning once you have, like, a dad in the hospital, and it's like...
Mm.
But anyway, what do I like about this movie? Well, I am a Jewish boy from New York, and I will say, like, I love the Adam Sandler parking scene, but then they walk into the house, and you've got Harold puttering around, and he's, like, yelling upstairs because, like, the door was left open, and Emma Thompson's yelling, like... It was the Con Ed guy, and he's like, it was 3 days ago. And I've just been in that house so many times mm-hmm. in my life, in my childhood. Like, so it was, but like, this is the thing, you're saying comfort zone. I mean, yes, he's in my comfort zone. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not going to deny this.
No.
So it feels, I think he has a real sense of detail with this stuff that always feels very funny and winning and like comfortable to me. What I love about the movie is the depiction of the two brothers and the weird duality of the depiction of the two brothers. Like, so the Adam Sandler part of the movie is a little languorous and kind of aimless. They're just sitting around. There's this big sequence where they go to MoMA in black tie, which is also a Step Brothers gag, I'm realizing. So maybe this is a Step Brothers homage.
It's Royal Tenenbaum Step Brothers movie.
But like, you know, they're both kind of lumps. Like Adam Sandler's kind of a better lump in that scene. And Hoffman, who's been in the news recently, I picked this movie before Dustin Hoffman was in the news. I don't mean to be too topical.
No, sorry.
God. Hoffman's like, you know, that's where Harold's really learning, like, or being reminded, like, oh, I am not an important artist. No one knows who I am. Like, right, you know. So you've got this big, long, aimless section that ends with nothing in particular. They go to the MoMA party. It's kind of a bummer. And Adam Sandler's like, I think I'm going to go stay with my sister for a while.
Yeah.
Right. And then you have this one-day scene with Stiller's character. Or is it maybe two? Because he's in L.A., I guess. There's, like, that opening little joke with Adam Driver's character. But, like, you know, where he's, like...
That's not... He's in New York, though, isn't he?
He is in New York. Yeah. Right, yeah, because they're making a lot for him. Right. Yes.
Right,
no,
right.
You're right.
And he plays some kind of rock star or something
he
who's
like
just frittering his money
like
away.
A pool.
Yeah.
Like, and Sandler's like, you don't need the pool right now. And he's, you know, and it's, like, a great scene of him talking this guy into convincing himself that he knows he doesn't need a pool, you know, rather than just telling him. But, no, and then it's, like, this sort of high tension... Also very relatable to me as a Manhattan Jew. Scene of them like going to restaurants and they don't like the seats and like the water is bad or what, like, you know. And that like this weird little like travelogue of a day that ends up at Candace Bergen's house that is so tightly wound. Like, and I love that.
Yeah.
You know, like that he's putting you in this sort of atmosphere and he's putting you in these people's bodies through how he tells each story. And then I love the hospital stuff too, because I've been in that situation. A lot of people have been in that situation. It's hard to capture on screen. Like the thing with like the nurse who you're like, this is the nurse who knows. I love this nurse. And this nurse has like 40 patients and is like, no, yeah, it's nice to see you. And like, but they're always talking about the nurse.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to point out one thing about the hospital scene. This is unrelated to my movie. My friend Pilot pointed out to me is there's a scene where Adam Sandler has a yogurt and a banana at the cafeteria.
Yes.
And he gets up and walks over another table to get salt and pepper. And sits back down. And I can't for the life. I now watch this movie twice. I don't know why he needs salt and pepper for a yogurt and a banana.
That opens a lot of questions about whether the salt and pepper goes on the banana or in the yogurt.
Is it all getting mixed together?
Yeah, is he going to dip the banana in the yogurt?
I don't know.
These are the questions that you really need to go to a press day for, just so you can be like Noah Baumbach.
Noah. I have interviewed him. I didn't interview him for this movie, but he's a nice interview. But anyway, and so, you know, it's building, but like... I'm sort of talking all over the place, but it's building to this wrestling with the dad's legacy at this art show, this pathetic art show at Bard,
right?
Where my brother went to college. I'm really deep.
You were deep in this movie. This movie speaks to you on a very personal level. I appreciate that.
It has a scene that I don't like. We can spoil.
Yeah, let's do it. If you're really afraid, this is not really a spoilable movie.
Exactly.
But like,
it has a climactic moment that I don't like, which is two grown men wrestling, pointlessly.
It's like stepbrothers in a bad way.
Exactly. Like that's a gag that there's just no reason to do it anymore. We've seen that.
There are occasionally hacky bits in this movie, considering that it is a movie.
That is the hackiest bit.
Yeah, and that is the hackiest bit.
What's another hacky bit, though?
I don't know. I just feel like... I don't have to go through
it. That's fine.
I just feel like every once in a while... And like for a movie that is like very supposed to be like grounded in specifics and like these kind of like subtle dramas and power dynamics and things, there are moments where it's like, oh, that's a little sitcom-y like that. Like the fighting.
And it feels like Baumbach being like, we need a sort of, you know, the emotions to build and sort of explode into this fight. But of course, then the fight will be very silly because they're two grown men.
Right. Like, yeah.
And I just don't think he needs that at all. Because what you really get is this scene where Stiller's character, who is a money man and knows what to do and has sold his father's home, starts crying as he like reckons with his legacy in this pathetic art show. And then Sandler gives the weird angry speech where he's like, he better be good or else like, why did I live with him my whole life with all this nightmare in my head? And it just got to me. I wish there wasn't the wrestling scene.
Yeah. It's funny because I like the movie more towards the end, but I think the last part is the weakest part.
This movie's too long.
Well, it also, like, it is in some ways, it's a movie about living with people. And so the idea of having to reach a point of catharsis is almost like antithetical.
Right. You
to
almost
what it's
just don't
do.
Want that.
Right.
Sure,
like
get
a
that.
Big moment, as much as like a movie cries out for that.
Because the big moment is, I guess, that Sandler realizes, like, I can't just, like, sit around with my dad.
Right, waiting for him to approve of me. And,
He doesn't die in his hospitalization. Right. And he's just back in his country home. And he's like, I need you to help me out. And, like, it's Sandler's character being like, well...
Right, I got a life of my own now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, which is a fine end point.
Yeah.
But you're saying you'd rather it was just like, well, they're all stuck together forever. Family.
That's
is misery.
It. That's how it works. Right.
Which and you is
don't,
fine.
You
yes.
don't necessarily. Yeah. You don't necessarily grow in those relationships. Sometimes you're just they're stuck where they are. And that's
is
how
true.
It is. I will say before we close up, the parts that I did really like about this were actually the parts in which you see like this older generation of New York kind of leaving New York. I mean, that is part of what this is about, which
call.
Is like, they have, it's like in the East Village, the house, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have an East Village house that
with
like
a basement.
Right.
That's his studio.
And like, it's which this... was like when they bought it, clearly it was just like an arty neighborhood that was like kind of a rundown neighborhood.
Right. And it's like
now...
a tenement house. It's very thin, very narrow.
And it's kind of cluttered with a whole lifetime's worth of stuff, detritus of like children and like collection, like artworks and all of that.
Yes.
And there's something like that is very poignant about like when they sell the house because it's now worth like millions of dollars, you know, and like people come in and are just already calculating about
they're
like
looking at the bones
water
of the
pressure
house.
And like, yes, well, they'll put this and that. And there is this like bit of sadness to be like, the idea that you could be a kind of failed artist
right.
in New York,
a mediocre artist who's yeah. also a college professor,
right,
you know,
right.
some money,
but that, like, but that's like a really difficult thing to do now.
Yeah, like, impossible to
like,
imagine
to live in Manhattan and mm-hmm. do that and have that kind of life. That's an era that is ending.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, you're right. I mean, that is, I'm sure, a little bit what he's wrestling with, too. Just like how Squid the Whale, you know, that one of the big things in Squid of the Whale is when the dad moves from Park Slope to yes. Leopard's Garden. And he's like an extra stop on the Q train. And
he makes all of these excuses for it, but it's also like...
It's such a...
Right, he's aware that he's been
loss
like...
Loss of status. Right. And, yeah. I mean, I really do like it. I'll admit, the second time I noticed... how long it was where the first time I was really in it, but I was watching it at home, which sometimes can make movies more boring.
That's
in
true.
My opinion.
That's true. I saw it in the New York Film Festival screening. So
sure. My first viewing was at a screening. Yes. And I will, yeah, the end, the last part, which is supposed to be long, feels long and you know, maybe a little aimless.
It ends multiple times.
It
the movie.
Ends like five times. Yeah.
But we do get one last thing with Emma Thompson, who is delightful. She's, didn't even talk about her. And
we didn't talk about her. She's reprising
funny.
Her Harry Potter performance. She's great. I mean, she very funny. Yes. The shark. Yes. She makes the
she
shark.
She cooks all of these hideous
I know
meals.
This woman, too. It's so, like, yeah, anyway. But I do like it. Yeah, I don't think Noah likes that it's on Netflix, but it's nice that it's on, you know, Netflix has this as part of the repertoire, I guess.
Yeah, you know, there are way worse movies for them to invest in.
Yeah.
And I'd happy to see more. Yeah. All right, well, that's
right.
The Meyerowitz Stories. You can find it on Netflix.
Good afternoon, Mr. Ward.
Good afternoon.
You live up on Johnson Road?
Yes.
You live there all your life?
Yes, I lived there all my life.
And you said you had a few brothers.
Yes.
Roscoe, Lyman, and William.
Yes.
Remember this question, Mr. Ward, from the statement. How do you feel about his pain? Remember that question being asked?
Yes, I remember that question being asked.
Remember the answer? I felt that he should go to the doctors. My feelings were that I felt Bill would be better off away from his pain, so he wouldn't be in pain and hollering anymore.
Well, I remember that.
You gave that statement, right?
Yes.
Remember this question? After Bill went to sleep, what did you decide to do?
Yes, I remember that question.
Remember giving this answer? I decided to put my hand over his mouth. I reached around behind him with my right hand and put it over his mouth. He struggled for a little bit, but then stopped. I wanted to make sure that Bill wasn't suffering anymore, that he was dead.
Yes, I remember that. Remember
so we are talking... adult brother movie. There's not really like a good way to say this.
Grown-up brothers.
It sounds like a little dirty if you say adult brother movies. Like it sounds like a... I don't know.
Well, and also, right, because when I was trying to pick movies, it's not like you can just Google like movies about brothers. I mean, there's a lot of brothers in movies.
Right. They haven't necessarily grown up yet.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But no, we were talking specifically about brothers who are no longer children and they are past that age of like, we all hang out together or maybe like, I kind of bully you because I'm the older brother. Mm-hmm. Well... maybe that still lasts a bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's really, I think, most interesting about these are the ways in which the dynamics you had or didn't have as children kind of get summoned, especially in Meyerowitz stories.
Yes.
Like how they bleed through when you're supposedly past all of those things. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's a broad category. I don't know if you have any other... do you have any other general thoughts about movies about adult brothers when you were like thinking of what to do?
Mostly that when I sort of suggested it, I was like, there's tons of movies like Meyerowitz out there, right? And I immediately was like, no, there aren't. It's actually an unusual... you know, sister movies, I feel like, are a little more common in a
right.
weird way.
Because it's a particular kind of movie aimed at women, which used to be like about your... fond or difficult relationship with your sister.
Right. And I think it is sort of an annoying binary thing, but it's true where it's like, you're not going to make a movie for men about like four men aimed at a male audience. That's like about like, isn't it hard to have a brother sometimes? Like, you know, they're going to make an action movie instead or whatever, you know, like, it's,
right.
So, which almost like, it's sort of surprising that Meyerowitz feels more unique than I thought it was.
Well, I think because
the movies I picked are not like the Meyerowitz stories.
Well, I think it's interesting, and this is true. Maybe I'll just use this to jump into my first pick.
Yes,
but like
jump
that,
in.
That it's, we don't really have a good template for how
brothers
are
be.
Supposed to be. Yeah,
yeah.
Like to maintain a grown up relationship. Mm. Because in like kind of like within the boundaries of like old traditional masculinity, you're not the ones like kind of burdened with keeping up those relationships, right? Like, it's the women in the family who are supposed to make sure everyone keeps in touch. And so we don't really have a good template for what it means, which is why I think that's like one of the things that's at the heart of Brother's Keeper, mm-hmm. which is my first pick, which is on Netflix, and is the 1992 doc from Joe Berlinger and the late Bruce Sanofsky. It was their first film. They would go on to make the Paradise Lost trilogy afterwards, which is a big deal, and then go on to make many other documentaries.
And
Metallica, Some Kind of Monster.
And
which one?
Blair Witch 2,
well, yes.
: Book of Shadows. One of the weirdest movies ever made.
It definitely is. They're like, sorry, it's good that you brought it up. They're ill-fated. Venture.
They had a good
fiction.
Idea for that movie, and I think it got screwed up and like taken away from them.
Yes,
but that movie's weird.
It is very weird. I was seated next to Joe Berlinger at a lunch like a few years ago, and he was telling me about how that movie like really kind of like became this turning point in his career, because he was like, I'm not sure what to do next. Mm-hmm. It was like so badly received, and it went so poorly.
Horribly received, unfairly. Well, it is pretty bad.
It's bad. It's interesting. Just because it's interesting
right.
doesn't mean it's not also bad.
I just think if you're going to make a sequel to Blair Witch, you should make a movie about people who saw the Blair Witch Project and are inspired by it.
Oh, yeah.
And some spooky stuff happens.
And
you
yet,
know?
Did that happen when they did the reboot? No, either. Yes.
The reboot was much worse. The reboot made Blair Witch 2 look good. Anyway, sorry.
Yes. No. So either way, basically, don't do anything new with the Blair Witch Project is the moral of this story.
Sure. Yeah.
But this doc, which they were starting, I think they made it when they were working for the Maisels, and it's definitely like a Maisel-style documentary, is about this 1990 alleged murder that happened in Munnsville, New York, in upstate. It's kind of a farming community. And the murder was of one of four brothers who lived together on this rundown house on a farm. The Ward boys, everyone would call them. Though they're not boys, they're like men in their 60s and 70s. They are gray-haired and bearded and extremely eccentric and apparently don't seem to take very good care of themselves.
Sort of gray gardens.
Yeah, it does have a bit of that. And then it's the death of Bill, which is one of the brothers, a brother who was ill, that becomes the center of the story. Bill was sick. And at first, his brother Delbert confessed to killing him as a mercy killing.
Mm-hmm.
And then he denied it. He said that he hadn't understood what was going on, that he was coerced. And all of the brothers are like barely literate.
Okay.
And it's unclear throughout if they have like a kind of mental disability, developmental disability, or if it's just that they weren't educated.
They've led this weird
kind of isolated life and they didn't get much education. But either way, they were very isolated. And what's really fascinating about this doc is that it follows as the community kind of suddenly takes up arms on behalf of these men who they were never very close to begin with, in part because it's like they're still one of theirs, as opposed to all of the outsiders who start descending on the community, the state police, and then the media, because this becomes a huge media, like... a crime that the media loves. Connie Chung at one point does a story on this. Yeah. So all these outsiders come to town. And there is, in a way, this very much like the more that they talk to the townspeople, the more that it kind of explores this like they're part of our community, not like you goddamn New Yorkers, you know?
Yeah.
And like, which is like a dynamic that continues to
it
be
does,
very, very
right?
relevant.
You don't understand because.
And the movie is very kind of. Very even-handed in terms as this like trial unfolds and as the coverage intensifies. But I think, like, as I said, key to this is this idea of like no one knows what to do with these brothers who just live by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That like there's one part where they ask some of the brothers, like, did you ever want to get married? And they're kind of like, yeah, no, not really. Like, I don't know, like, bring a woman here, like, could I do that? Like, yeah. And they're clearly not, I think, as kind of slow-witted as the defense actually wants to try and portray them as,
sure.
as being like almost children in old man's bodies. But at the same time, there is like the question remains at the middle. And there is this hint of like incest there that like the brother was killed. There was semen on his leg. The brothers both like they shared two beds. And so that was part of the reason it was such a media, there was a media frenzy over this. But I think speaks to, like, the interest in that speaks to the fact that, like, there is this idea that as men they should have gone off and, you know.
Yes,
it is
right.
unseemly
what, they
in
have
a way.
Violated the rules of society by not, like,
right, it is unseemly, yes,
right,
to be
yeah.
a group of men living together like this.
Yes.
And that the kind of, the ways in which the movie allows that to be and allows the different ways that people react to it is really, I think it's both like very delicately handled and really, I think like very smartly done. Like especially as a doc that kind of like keeps its opinions to itself.
Right. It's not taking a stance like these men are innocent. These are
right. Sure, yeah. But yeah, it's a great documentary and it is streaming on Netflix. It's definitely worth a look. It is interesting that you bring up Grey Gardens because it definitely feels like it occupies a place in between Grey Gardens and Paradise Lost.
Right. Right.
Like it is like falls
right.
squarely
it's true
in the
crime,
middle.
But yes. It's also a bunch of weirdos in the
yes,
house.
And yes. eccentrics and like endearing eccentrics. Yeah. So yeah, that's my first pick, Brother's Keeper on Netflix.
I've never seen it. I'm all right. My first pick is Basket Case, the 1982 horror film by Frank Henenlotter, who is mostly famous for making the Basket Case movies, of which he made three. He also made Frankenhooker.
Okay. That I've heard of.
Yeah. You never heard of Basket Case?
No.
Oh, wow. Okay, so Basket Case is a very, very cheaply made comedy horror film that is still quite gory, but, you know, it definitely, you know, the tongue is in cheek throughout, about a young man by the name of Dwayne, played by Kevin Van Hentenrick. I'm looking at my phone for these because I do not, I mean, these are not professional. They don't seem like professional actors. This movie has a, you know, 80s porn film level of sort of acting quality. A lot of people basically almost looking at the camera as they say their lines. You know what
that.
I mean? Yeah. And he's a young guy in New York City. He's moved in to like a flop house basically in like Times Square. And this is a real great like New York in the 80s movie, shot right on Times Square, made for no money, and it's a, you know, a depiction of a community that is lost for okay. better or worse. And he has a basket with him, a big basket. Yes, no, this is not just a metaphorical basket case.
Okay.
And in his basket in his basket is his brother, who is, well, he's like a sort of like a torso with arms, and like there's kind of a face in the torso.
Okay.
He's a monster. He was like a conjoined twin who was cut off of him when they were born together.
Yes.
And as a teenager, they were separated, but they share a mental bond
of course.
Because of this late, what do you call a deconjoining? what a separation. His brother is called Belial. And which I think is like a demonic, and you know he likes to kill people.
I mean, who doesn't?
Which mostly, you know, so he's mostly a puppet.
Okay.
Who kind of like waves his arms around? Once in a while, he's stop motion, and those scenes are tremendous. But he mostly kills you just kind of by like putting his paw, his little claw on your face, and you're like, ah, and then there's like blood everywhere. It's very lo-fi. But anyway, this is a movie about their bond.
Yes.
And, you know, how Dwayne has to look after his basket brother, but also knows that his basket brother just wants to murder people. So it's kind of like trying to find the right people for him to murder, trying to kind of keep him at bay. But Dwayne's also trying to
make a life for himself. Yeah.
And he falls for a girl. Belial doesn't like that.
No, of course not.
Now, Belial can't talk. He just sort of goes like, ah! But, you know, you get the impression. but he talks in Dwayne's head, so Dwayne will have conversations with himself. It is just a life. Well, it's streaming on Shudder. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I didn't even say that. This is SVU. Yes, it's on Shudder for free. It's like a great example of those kinds of 80s horror movies where people, I feel like, could suddenly like make these schlocky movies for no money, maybe, that like, you know, on a basically a professional level.
No.
That rather like, you know, that just know they're shockingly silly. They know they're silly, not shocking. They are shocking. And like they're trying to have fun. Like there's no, you know, there's no thematic real reason for how gory it is, or like, you know, why there's this one scene where a woman undresses or whatever, you know, but like,
you're just throwing in all things for like titillation and to provoke you.
Where, yeah, it's like the movie just kind of has like a blunt stick and it's kind of poking you with it.
Uh-huh.
And like, you're tickled by it. And it's just kind of delightful. And sweet is strong, but affecting in a way. Uh-huh. Has these terrible flashback scenes where you see him as a kid with the doll attached to him, and those are the worst parts. But you know, it's like it's honestly the first thing that sprung to my mind when I was thinking about brother movies, because there's something about this image of this real like hick kid, you know, walking down 42nd Street with a wicker basket the size of an ottoman, you know, a giant wicker basket under his arm. That is, it is sweet. Like, it's so sort of like strangely sentimental that he's like, because he could look, Belial doesn't have feet. Like, you know, he could get away from him pretty quickly. He just get in a car and like move to another right. city. Like that, he like can't shake his bond to this monster, as terrible as this monster is. And this movie, you know, it's mostly just fun to watch. You know, it has creepy moments when the monster's eyes go red and he's sort of shrieking. Like, it's a little jarring, but it's just a movie about how these brothers, and, you know, I'm sure it doesn't have the best view. I mean, it doesn't have the most evolved view of Siamese twins. I shouldn't have the conjoined twins.
You know, who have had a long run in movies
exactly.
of dealing with difficult things.
So ignoring that, you know, it is about this sort of inexorable bond of family, right? Like, because I'm sure this movie's also sort of just thinking like, well, a conjoined twin, you literally can't escape them, right? Even if you're separated from them.
Right.
Forget that. Just think of them as brothers. And then I feel like this movie becomes like kind of affecting, even though it's like totally stupid and disgusting. It's great. God, it's great. It's a genuinely great movie.
What's in the basket?
Yeah, I definitely would like to see that movie. Yep. And also, like, when I was thinking of this topic, I did think of both Stuck on You and Dead Ringers, you know?
Yeah, I definitely thought of Dead Ringers.
Sure.
That was one I mean, that's a great brother movie.
That is. And that's also streaming on Shudder if you're interested in checking it out and you have not seen that movie. Just incredible.
It is. And it literally, yeah, it has, oh, Jeremy Irons is incredible in that movie. I love that movie.
It's so good.
Yeah.
All right. So you had mentioned that you did not think that there was really an equivalent of like a brother movie that was like the chick flick style thing for women with movies about sisters. But I will say, I think my next pick basically is, because it is a man weepy. It is super violent, but it is absolutely just like leaning the most like sneakily sentimental movie. And part of what I like about it is that it basically has to cloak all of this in extreme violence in order to be about manly emotion, sibling emotion. It is Warrior, which is available for rent right now. This would be Gavin O'Connor's 2011 mixed martial arts extravaganza starring Tom Hardy and Joel Edgerton as two estranged brothers who are even more estranged from their alcoholic dad, played by Nick Nolte, which, as we discussed before this, got an Oscar nomination this movie.
Yeah.
This movie is not a hit at the time. It was not a financial success, though it wasn't like...
It wasn't like a bomb.
Yeah, it wasn't a bomb. It didn't do as well as they clearly hoped. And especially for something that is like a crowd pleaser like this. But it has since crept up, unsurprisingly perhaps, in the internet's estimation. I was looking this up and it's like in the hundreds of the IMDb top 250.
Which is an interesting barometer. Maybe not the best, but
no,
it is a
but
real
I think
barometer.
It's, like, it's very telling about the type of movie this is, which I very sincere, like, I really like this movie. Yeah, so Hardy plays a character named Tommy, who was a Marine, who is back from being deployed in the Middle East. I don't know if they actually say Iraq or where he's, but like, so he's back. And he's like, clearly something happened that was bad. And he goes and turns up at his dad's doorstep. It's basically like, I don't want to repair this relationship, but you can start training me again.
Right.
And his dad is sober and wants to repair this relationship despite what he's just been told. And he's like, yeah, sure. I'll win you over, terrifying Tom Hardy. Meanwhile, Edgerton's character is like a former, not that successful UFC fighter who became a physics teacher, is a dad, owns a house, and is upside down in his mortgage. I think one of the things that is actually, in a way that like, it was like kind of ahead of its time, like this is a movie about white poverty,
yep.
or like, and white, what's the term? Economic economic uncertainty, as they
economic
say.
Economic anxiety.
Yes, economic anxiety.
For, yes.
But it is about, like, it's all set in, like, Pennsylvania.
Yep.
And then, like, the final sequence when there's a big tournament is in Atlantic City. But it is about about various characters who are basically like desperate to one save their house and right. the other to like give money to one of his the people he serves with her widow. Mm-hmm. So right. it is like not, it is all just fueled by needing money.
Right. There's no craving of fame in the, or whatever, or like
right.
opulence. It's
right.
just
there's
like,
this kind
yeah,
of like weird sadness.
Low rung. Let's try to survive.
Yeah. And there is something about the way, and in a weird way that I think like has this kind of honesty to it that I think sometimes boxing movies struggle with, which mm-hmm. is that like, it's like you are literally like, beating someone, beating the pulp out of someone for the amusement of like a crowd of screaming people.
Right.
And in this case,
and the
like,
UFC is even yeah, rawer
right.
in that regard.
And in
yes.
this case, there's like, the tournament is literally funded by like, I think a tech billionaire or something
right.
who's just like, I want to see who the toughest man of all time is.
Right.
So
right.
it's really just like, just like, are you not entertained?
Right. It's a blood sport.
But
yeah.
it is like super entertaining movie. Like all of the fighting is like super violent and extremely entertaining. Mm-hmm. You know, Hardy not quite become the A-lister that I think he is at this point, but he...
This is the year before Dark Knight Rises,
yeah,
right?
And
so
he's already...
Sort of swole
that's
mode.
It. Like,
yeah.
he's in this kind of shape that, like, makes him look... He like his neck is gone. Like yeah. it's just his shoulders just like go right up into his ears. He's just like so buff and like is so legitimately frightening and mesmerizing mm-hmm. in this. He seems, I feel like he has no lines at all.
He's like, an astonishing physical actor.
He really is.
Yeah.
And I just like, he's so compelling in this. And Edgerton like gets the kind of the more underdog role, but is also, I mean, it's been like, he's the dad and he's the teacher. And I think, you know, it's the less showy role, but he's very good in it.
Yeah. He's a good actor too.
So you won't forgive me, but you forgave Pop. No, he's just some old vet that I train with. You know, he means nothing to me. And what I hear, he means nothing to you either. You got balls talking about forgiveness.
That has nothing to do with forgiveness. I got children, man. I got a family to protect. Everything I do is for them. I forgave Pop. Just like I forgave you and Mom.
You forgave us?
Yeah.
I'm not surprised you made the tournament, Brennan. You got some stones, man.
There's something about this movie that I love, that it becomes this like operatic story of how two brothers will like get like kind of contend with this horrible pain of their childhood by like, of course, eventually meeting in the ring and just like hurting each other horribly, but like in this weird, like because it's UFC, it's also like they're literally hugging each other because they're grappling on the floor. Mm-hmm. And there was something about that where I was just like, this is like what this extremely testosterone heavy movie needs to do in order to have them reconcile. And there's right. something kind of weirdly
honest.
Lovely and honest about that.
Yeah.
That it is like, it is the kind of movie that is like fully aims to make you bawl at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But it does that in with these two characters who have like just tried to like choke each other out in a mixed martial arts cage.
Yeah, in an octagon.
In an octagon. Yes. Yeah. So I fully recommend this movie. I think I've talked about it ages and ages ago on the podcast, but you know, I rewatched it the other night and it's like still good.
Yep.
Ridiculous. I think it has a I can't remember the song that's the national song, I think, is like the...
Okay, right.
Yes,
that rings a vague. I have seen this movie.
That like plays a major emotional part in it. Start a War, I think it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's the kind of movie this is. It's a mixed martial arts movie that wants to make you cry mm-hmm. and that features heavily a song by the National.
I feel like, yeah, and the boy weepies are often the sports movies, right? Yeah, that is a classic way of getting to that... whatever emotional the Tootsie Pop, you know, the center of the Tootsie Roll Pop. I like that movie a lot. I haven't seen it since theaters, but now I'm gonna watch it again.
Well, it's available for rent.
Yes. And my second pick, well, so it's funny that you mentioned Dead Ringers, which is a movie I thought about picking because it is such an obvious, but then I went with another David Cronenberg movie. Mm. History of Violence.
One.
It's a movie I really love. And it's such a, for rewatching it for this, I forget, it's such a lean movie. It's 90 minutes long and it's really like five scenes, you know, like, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, it's so even though it's not like, it doesn't feel like a fast-paced movie exactly, it's so punchy and just like gets,
it's like pared down,
right, lean, whatever. Yeah. So that's a 2005 sort of I guess like a, it's sort of a neo-noir. It was based on a graphic novel that's pretty different, but you know, that's where they drew inspiration from. That Cronenberg made, it was kind of his return to like making movies people watched again. His yes. Spider was his last, which is a decent movie, but like, you know, he had that 90s wilderness sort of, and
yep.
where he's making really aggressively strange movies. And this is more of like a, it's very violent, but very watchable thriller.
I'm a big defender of Existence, though.
Existence is pretty great. But that movie's, you know, it's
weird.
Oh,
yeah, no, it's really weird.
And so it's about Tom Stahl, Viggo Mortensen, who's right off of Lord of the Rings at that point, who's a diner owner in a tiny town in Indiana, who has a wife, Edie, who's Maria Bello. Remember when she was a thing?
Yeah, I like her, and I wish
too.
She was in more movies.
It's a bummer. I feel like this was right her moment, because she was in The Cooler, and she was in a... There's another movie that she's really good in right around. Anyway, love Maria Bello. He's got a son and a daughter. And really early on, after this sort of opening scene where we see these two robbers leaving their last crime scene, they try and rob his restaurant, and Tom annihilates them. With precision.
It's funny. It's like, it's one of those things where you're like, is it fair to call this an action scene? It feels like a scene of violence.
It's a scene of very yes. brief but very effective violence. It's an action scene.
Yeah.
It's mostly tension, because this movie is all tension. You know, because it's like the bad guys sort of terrorizing everyone in the diner. That's like 5 minutes, and then when things sort of reach a point where another woman is in trouble, Tom just sort of springs into, like, he clocks one of them with a coffee cup, he shoots the other one, he shoots the other, like, you know, and he's hailed as a small town hero, and that's all great, but he seems very disturbed by the attention, and then a one-eyed, black suit-clad, sunglasses-wearing guy, played by Ed Harris, shows up, and he's like, "How you doing, Joey?" "Can I have another cup of coffee, Joey?" I love this movie.
It's a really good movie.
And it's a great movie. And so, you know, and I'm going to have to spoil this movie a little bit to get to the brother part.
Okay, fair warning if you're worried
if you
about it.
Just go rent this movie. Yeah, it's available for rent. It's, you know.
Jesus, Joey.
Can I swear on this podcast? I forget. No. Okay. Yeah. So there's another line that is so good, but I will not. But anyway, so no. And eventually, of course, it is revealed that this Ed Harris mobster is calling him by his real name. And Tom Stahl was once a Philly gangster who was a real nasty piece of work, and who took out Ed Harris's eye with a piece of barbed wire, which, is, you know, after he, you know, there's a lot of the dynamics with his wife are also very interesting that I won't get into now, because there's a lot in this going on in this movie, but he is finally lured back home to this sumptuous mansion in Philadelphia where his brother, played by William Hurt, lives, and is kind of like, the hell happened to you, you know, like, and they have this showdown that is just like an electrifying 10-minute scene of brothers reckoning with each other, and William Hurt, who was not Oscar nominated, which was highly deserved, and it felt like Hurt was back, you know, and then he wasn't really back, which is too bad, but
yeah,
that's another conversation. Communicates so much about how messed up their relationship is and how inferior he feels to Viggo Mortensen. And like, even to this day, even though he's this like crime lord in this big house and he obviously like commands the Philly mob, and like, you know, the sort of inadequacies of like these very masculine brotherly relationships. And do you like this movie? You like this movie?
I love this movie.
It's so good.
I think, outside of even like all of these dynamics that you talked about, it does really have some of the most interestingly filmed violence I've
incredible
ever
violence.
Seen. Like, it never is both thrilling
from a man who knows from violence, no,
right.
too. Yes,
thrilling and also disturbing. He never lets you forget just like the really viscerally awful, mm-hmm. fleshly consequences of this violence.
There's two shots that are kind of like probably like 2 second insert shots where you're just sort of like, you've never seen a wound like that yeah. before. And it's not even that it's sort of like absurd or over the top. It's just like you say, right? Like there's some little dangling bit of skin or something and you're just like, oh my God.
Right.
Oh my God. And right, of course, this is a man who is violent in a way that is very frightening, but as Cronenberg knows, like, is also really, it's cool. And, you know, like, there is something magnetic about, like, how eerily powerful, like, he is when he's in this killer mode.
Right, like, it makes him suddenly a more compelling person even to the people in his lives
who've
known
him.
Yes, it does. They're suddenly looking at him with new light.
Right, like, and it sort of radiates out, and it starts to affect the way his wife behaves, the way his son behaves. It's a great, great movie.
It's one of the
best movies of 2005. Available for rent on iTunes and Amazon and all those.
You should see this
services.
Movie. See this yes. movie.
Hey, let's do Get Help.
What?
Get Help.
No.
Come on, you love it.
I hate it.
It's great. It works every time.
It's humiliating.
Do you have a better plan?
No.
We're doing it.
We are not doing Get Help.
Get Help! Please! My brother's dying! Get help!
David Sims.
Yes.
Let's talk Thor Ragnarok.
Sure.
This is the time in the podcast where we look briefly to things that are not streaming yet. Mm. To things that who knows where they will end up streaming given these new deals that are always
That's
being made.
True. The
confusing
Disney deal is expiring, right? Or whatever.
Yes,
so will Ragnarok happen?
You may have to pay for a Disney only streaming service in the future.
One might say that the film industry is in its own Ragnarok right now.
One might definitely say that.
Uh-huh.
But in the meantime, we have this delightful superhero movie, the latest in the MCU from mm-hmm. Taika Waititi, of What We Do in the Shadows and Boy. Going to the big time with this one, with is it the third Thor movie?
Yes.
I don't know. Thor. Like, always been, let's just say it, he's been the weakest.
No, I don't agree. Thor's my favorite.
Oh, no, I forgot that you have this terrible stance. Why did I agree to talk about this movie? All right, go ahead. Lay out your defense of Thor.
Well, no, I think what you're saying is probably fair, which is that of the three big Avengers,
right?
Thor, Iron Man, and
each
Captain
of their
America.
Separate strands right. of like individual movies. I mean, it's weird to think of them as individual movies these days because they're so like they blur more and more.
They do blur. Some are more individual than others,
yes.
certainly. And yeah, so Iron Man's had three solo movies. So has Captain America. Now so has Thor. Mm-hmm. And Thor is maybe like the redheaded stepchild of the three a little bit, like especially because his movies tend to interact the least with the Marvel world
right.
at large.
They take place in the silliest,
Asgard.
At least, yes, at the time at least, especially in the beginning mm-hmm. when this was a bit more grounded.
Right.
When they were like, the Marvel movies are going to be, we're going to ease you in.
Yeah,
at this
sure.
point, we're at full comic book, like
right,
unapologetically
Which I actually like about it. But yeah, I remember, of course, way back when Marvel announced, like, we're doing this, we're doing it. And they announced, like, Iron Man's a very grounded movie, considering.
Right.
And, like, they announced Captain America, and it's going to be a World War II movie, and you're like, fine. And then they were like, Thor. And I was like, how are they going to do Thor?
Right. Like, Thor is pretty silly.
He's
on, like,
god.
Yeah.
A Norse god. But here we are. I love the Thor movies.
Mm.
I mean, Kenneth Branagh's Thor
uh-huh.
is it's a flawed film.
Yes.
I think it's also budgetarily limited. It doesn't look
sure.
fantastic. But I just love the sort of unapologetic kind of D&D like silliness of those movies. I think Chris Hemsworth is a very fun, sort of actor with a good sense of himself, like, a good sense of his screen presence and how to push it into funny places. And those movies have Tom Hiddleston in them, who's usually he's a real MVP of the Marvel Universe
yeah,
at large.
He's really held it together in some ways.
He helps a lot. People really hate Thor the Dark World, the second Thor movie.
Yeah, people do hate that movie.
And I feel like often when, someone has the incredibly unique and original idea of ranking the Marvel movies, not to diss anyone who does that because, it's fine. The Dark World's always right there at the bottom, right?
Mm.
Like, people like to make fun of the Dark World. I love the Dark World. I think it's the best. I think it's so much fun. So I was going into Ragnarok maybe a little different because I feel like a lot of people were like, oh, maybe this is a good Thor movie.
You were like, they're all good.
I'm like,
I feel like the Thor movies are just like the most... As we get more and more Marvel movies, I find that some of them kind of slip away from my memory very quickly. And fair. I feel that the Thor ones maybe do that the most quickly. Mm-hmm. Despite my really enjoying Chris Hemsworth's kind of like, you know, hunky, godlike moron kind of attitude. So I think it's really...
A beefcake.
Yes, I think he's very funny. And I think the fact that he gets to be really funny in this installment is like a plus. It's certainly, this is definitely my favorite of the Thor movies.
Sure.
I think it just goes like way out there. It doesn't try to put anything grounded remotely in this.
Nope.
It's, I do still find it evaporates pretty quickly.
I did too. I was actually surprised. I was pretty hyped up for this movie and I enjoyed watching it. Had a great time. It's not really a Thor movie, which isn't even a complaint by me, but like, you know, it's really like a, it's like a Bob Hope and Bing Crosby movie. You know, like, it's just like, we all know Thor. What if he went on a wacky adventure into space, right? I mean, like, and then some stuff happens. Like, what does it have to do with Thor? I don't know. You know, what does it have to do with Asgard?
Throw it in somehow. Like,
And so I basically like the movie when it is just being the wacky road movie. I do feel like it struggles a little more when it tries to, you know, still have Asgard and have this plot with this villain played by Cate Blanchett.
Right. And she, as much as I find her delightful, the movie doesn't really know what to do with her. It doesn't know what she wants, really, or what her powers are, or what, like, it's, she's this force of destruction, but, like, she's just kind of there because they need a villain.
Yeah, and I think it's a movie where they're sort of like, we know we don't really have a great villain, like many a Marvel movie.
Right.
But if Cate Blanchett plays it, then it'll pop more, which is probably true.
She has very cool horns. Mm. She throws knife things, sword things, whatever. I don't really understand what her
knife
powers are.
Yeah, they were
kind of
lame. What are her powers?
I don't know.
She's very powerful.
She is.
I mean, that's her power.
Mostly that's it. She's just scary.
Very powerful.
She's very terrifying.
And it's, you know, this is a classic superhero movie, like the Wolverine, which is another great underrated superhero movie, does this, where it takes Thor's hammer away right at the start, which is in the trailer. I mean, I'm not giving anything away here. So it's kind of being like, what if Thor was not, you know, all-powerful god anymore? He's just like a dude who has to,
well, like the basic thing you do with Thor, though, is like, what if Thor didn't have, because we've got someone with godlike powers.
It's tough.
Yeah. One thing this movie does have going for it, Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Magnificent.
I was seated very close to you at the screening, and in his scenes, you were laughing.
I was delighted. I was so happy. There is one scene where, I think I even made a gif of it, where he just basically...
I know what you're about to say.
Silent, where he makes a series of expressions.
He looks in the camera in a good way.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it's just like... And it just is fascinating.
I think it's special that the Marvel movies are now at the point where they're just like, any actor will be in them.
Yes.
I mean, you're getting Cate Blanchett, like, right? You know, and they're pretty happy to be like, you got any ideas? Because, like, just have fun, right? And Goldblum is the perfect fit for that kind of thing. I mean, his character is not important in any larger sense. He just has to sort of hold court for a few scenes. So it's just wonderful to watch him work the room, like, right?
I mean, all of the best parts of this movie are the ones in which, like, YTT kind of lets flickers of his own movies come through, where it's just like, he's just like, I enjoy you as a performer.
Yes.
Or the character that he voices himself.
That's the best character.
Who's a great character. Yeah, like, you know, there's less and less room for personality, individual director personality in the Marvel universe, I feel. There's a push and pull.
In the main ones, no. Like, in the Russo brother movies, no.
Sure. But why are those more main than anything else?
Well, I mean, the ones where everyone's grouped together. Side ones, I feel like there's a little more like, have some fun.
But there's still, I mean, like, this movie still has a lot of business to get through.
It does.
That there are times where you're like, this would be more fun if it just kind of, like, dawdled with Jeff Goldblum, like, holding court. It's a good time.
A good time. I mean, you know, I do kind of salute Marvel for 20 movies in or whatever they are.
Still making entertaining movies.
I mean, it's a formula, but it's a good formula that people want to go to the movie theater to see, which is hard. to do these days.
And speaking of that, let's move on to Behind the Eight Ball, the segment in which we run through three releases that are new to streaming, two that were recommended by you, our listeners, and one selected randomly from our Netflix My Lists. David, why don't you go first here, since you were the guest?
Should I say the one from my Netflix My List?
Why don't you give us three new releases first?
Three new releases that I picked are number one, which I believe, well, I just found out that it was today, it's on Amazon, is Speed Racer.
Excellent choice.
The Wachowskis, well, it's not their best film. It would be silly even for me, an avowed Speed Racer fan, to say it's their best film, but a highly underrated film from the Wachowskis. That sort of captures the cartoony magic of the thing they're adapting in a way that, like, no other cartoon adaptation has ever even come close to attempting. It is one of the most wonderful visual spectacles. It's like getting something injected, like, directly into your forehead. It's a little intense. It's a very, very heightened. But I mean, I love Speed Racer.
Oh yeah, I think we've talked about it on this. I feel like we have talked about it on this podcast, and I tried to find it because I definitely confess to getting teary in the big finale, just because it goes so big.
The finale is amazing.
It's incredible. But
that movie, it's sincere all the way. That's a fastball down the middle of sincere. John Goodman plays a character called Pops, and he is Pops Racer, father of Speed Racer. And at no point does the movie wink at the camera about the fact that this man was born Pops. It's his name. No, it's just, you know, like, everything is just straight down the middle because that's the tone they've decided on, and it works, I think.
What's your number two pick?
The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, which I believe is also on Amazon. Mm-hmm. Andrew Dominik's film from, what's the year? When did that come out? 2007, I believe. That is a painterly and languorous film about celebrity in the Old West and sort of, like, you know, all the iconography of the bandits and the cowboys of that era. And it's a neo... I love Westerns in general. It's a neo-Western that I think makes all the right calls, you know, about sort of, like, puncturing... you know, the obvious sort of myths of the era without winking at the camera, like while still being this, like, sort of stirring and gorgeous movie. I mean, you know what it's about. It's about the man who shot Jesse James, Casey Affleck.
It's in the title.
It's a spoiler alert. Casey Affleck and Brad Pitt, both career work for both of them, I think. Especially for Pitt, who's almost underrated in that movie because I feel like Casey Affleck got a lot of the buzz at the time, and he got the Oscar nomination and all that. But Pitt, who is like playing on his star persona in a really, like, sort of interesting way. I'm talking too much.
Oh, what's your third pick?
42. This is on Netflix, I think. Mm-hmm. Brian Helgeland's Jackie Robinson biopic, which is not great, I'm going to be honest. It's not, like, the best movie ever made. It's probably not the Jackie Robinson biopic we deserved after all these years. Because remember, I mean, like, Spike Lee tried to make it. Like, it was always a movie that was in the works. But it is, I think it's a fascinating movie for two reasons. One, it was the beginning of the Chadwick Boseman moment that lasts to this day, where this kid, I didn't know him at all, like, this actor where you're like, who is this guy?
Not was, a kid, though. Which
not
is,
a
I think
kid.
That's
no,
the
he
thing.
Was like 30 when this movie came out. He's old.
I know. I think he's 40.
Yeah. Looking great, Chadwick. I mean, he's surprisingly, like, stoic and, you know, even though the movie doesn't have, like, a very hot take on Jackie Robinson, still, like, invests him with a lot of, you know, humanity and energy. And also, this was the movie, I think, that starts with, like, Harrison Ford trying again. I don't think it's his best performance, but it's sort of where you see, like, something, like, the embers have lit in Harrison Ford again. He goes on, you know, he gave some good performances after this, after years in the wilderness. And this is the genesis point, this sort of basically forgettable, fine biopic.
You think God likes baseball, Herb?
What the hell is that supposed to mean?
It means someday you're going to meet God. And when he inquires as why you didn't take the field against Robinson in Philadelphia, and you answer that it's because he was a Negro, it may not be a sufficient reply.
42.
42. All right, give me two listener recommendations.
Okay. Both of these come from Kendall. You got Hinterland, which is on Netflix, which is a Welsh police noir series with beautiful scenery and dark mysteries. It's got Welsh accents, the lovely, I can speak from experience, sing-songy kind of accents. It's got the Welsh names. It's got the dramatic Welsh mountainous landscapes. It falls into tropey writing at times, but is mostly filled with very compelling mysteries. Classic British mystery show. Every episode's 90 minutes long. There's three seasons, about 4 or 5 episodes each. That's how they make TV over there.
Well, it is.
Yep. And then there's Mother, not Darren Aronofsky's
Mother! Exclamation!
Mother!
Exclamation point, right.
I wish I could find the way to say it, which is also on Netflix. It's a 2009 Korean film, a mystery drama from Bong Joon-ho, who made Okja this year for Netflix. In fact, about the murder of a high school girl, in which a local mentally disabled teenage boy becomes the prime suspect in the murder, and his mother is resolute in trying to prove his innocence and protect him. That is a wonderful movie.
It is a tremendous movie. That is a very good recommendation.
Yes.
All right. And give me one from your Netflix My List.
So you gave me number 9, which was The Wave. You know The Wave?
The action movie?
Yeah,
the Scandinavian one?
2015, I believe. Is it a Norwegian film directed by...
It's a good name.
Roar Uthaug.
Uh-huh.
Uthaug. How do you say that last name?
I don't know. That sounds good.
Who is, I think, going to be a Hollywood fixture because he's making the Tomb Raider reboot with Alicia Vikander. For $6 million made this apocalypse movie about a big old wave.
I have seen this movie.
Does a lot with not a lot of resources.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's it's kind of a calling card. It's kind of like give me
very much
Hollywood,
a calling card movie.
Give me a okay, for my three new releases, I've got new to Netflix is Alias Grace, which would be the Canadian co-production miniseries that is basically just like a list of Canadian royalty. Directed by Mary Harron, starring Sarah Gaydon, adapted from Margaret Atwood by Sarah Polley.
Right, it's all Canadian.
It's like the most, and I think that David Cronenberg might have a guest appearance. I mean, like I think he shows
better.
Up. I know. I feel like you're actually almost not allowed to make that series without at least some mention of David Cronenberg
there. Exactly. He should like do the catering or something.
I know. At least just show up to like Wave.
The Wave.
He does. He has a role.
Yep.
He's Reverend Verringer.
He's a good actor. He's always good as like reverends, doctors,
evil scientists. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that is new to Netflix. I have not watched it yet, but I am really looking forward to it.
I hear it's great.
It. I hear
I'm
it's
very
great
excited.
Too.
Yeah.
Also new to Netflix is 11/8/2016, a movie that is actually also new in theaters.
Yes.
Documentary, though I think for some it may play as a bit of a horror film.
Yep.
It's kind of a super group documentary, got the work of multiple filmmakers around the country, curated by Jeff Deutschman. He also made 11/4/08, which was a similar documentary shot around the country on the day that Barack Obama was first elected. Mm. 11/8/2016 is obviously a movie about the day Donald Trump became president.
Oh, did
might have happened. Uh-huh. Maybe we'll read differently, but anyway, if you would like to revisit that day, which maybe you wouldn't, there's a documentary about it currently on Netflix. And finally, new to Fandor is Reprise. Have you seen this movie?
I have, yes.
I love this movie.
He's
from
a great director.
Yeah, Norwegian filmmaker Joachim Trier. Which is not quite...
We both picked Norwegians.
I know, not quite as action-y a name as Roar.
Roar!
Yeah. He has a new movie out, Joachim Trier, Thelma,
mm-hmm.
is coming
next week
out soon.
Or very soon. Yeah.
Um, But this movie, Reprise, was his debut and a film I loved about two young men who both set out to become the next great Norwegian novelist. And it becomes all about like friendship and rivalry, about being like a wunderkind and mm-hmm. about like the burdens that can come with that, but also about the idea of romanticizing different types of instability as the mark of a true artist and how that was just like BS, mm-hmm. you know, in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But it is a great, exciting, and beautifully made movie, and that is streaming on Fandor. Mm-hmm. For my listener recommendations, I've also got two from the same person. These are both from Chris in Pittsburgh, who recommends first Father Brown, who he writes, it's now streaming on Netflix, based on stories and characters by G.K. Chesterton.
Oh, I love G.K. Chesterton. You know,
and the style and structure will be familiar to anyone who watches BBC Mystery Series. You I imagine that you used to spend all of your time like watching
like old like
cozy
type.
Solving right. Crimes.
Yeah.
You love Midsummer Murders.
Rosemary and Thyme. That was my favorite. They were gardeners who solved murders.
Anyway, so Chris writes, the title character is a small town Catholic priest who, much to the chagrin of the local inspector, is a gifted sleuth. It is a warm, clever, occasionally surprising, and thoroughly British series. So if you're out of Poirot episodes, it should scratch a similar itch. And then second is Krzysztof Kieslowski, I'm So-So, is streaming on Filmstruck. But it's a bit tricky to find. It's actually one of the bonus features on Three Colors Red on their Criterion Collection station. But there's much more than a traditional bonus. It's an hour-long conversation with the great director, film shortly before he passed away, and it's the closest many of us will ever come to spending time in the presence of true genius. Considering that it played at a few film festivals in 1995 and has been almost impossible to find since then, this is the perfect time to catch up with that. That is a great recommendation, Chris. I didn't realize that was on there.
I'm going to watch that.
Yeah. Awesome. And finally, on my Netflix, my list, you gave me number 12.
I did.
This is The Death and Life of Marsha P. Johnson.
Mm.
It's a Netflix original documentary. We've talked about the just like fire hose of content that Netflix has been stepping up, even like the flow here. But this is a movie came from Oscar nominated
David France.
Yeah, David France.
I've seen
How to Survive a Plague. I have not yet. I added it to my Netflix, and it's just like slowly getting pushed down.
Yep.
But it's about Marsha P. Johnson, who was, a trans kind of icon and an activist, and who was involved, so much of Stonewall, and all of that. But also then kind of died under mysterious circumstances, mm-hmm. and the documentary kind of like looks into. It was like called a suicide, but kind of the documentary looks into that. I don't know. It's a movie that I feel like I would like to see and enjoy seeing, but there's so many movies, David.
There's a lot of movies, especially this time of year. And it's hard to make time for the depressing documentaries among them. But I was pretty engrossed by that movie. The election documentary I will never watch. Not in a million years.
I feel bad because there are a lot of great people involved with it.
Yes, but I've heard it's actually really good.
It's I know. The idea of going back to that point is really difficult.
Yep.
Well, David,
oh my God.
That is the end of this episode of Film Spotting SVU. It's been so great having you here joining me.
It's been very exciting to be on this show.
Where can people find more of your work?
I work at The Atlantic, where I'm a film critic and I write about movies. So you can always find me there. I'm on Twitter at David L. Sims. And I have a podcast called Blank Check, in which Griffin Newman, who is an actor and comedian and a friend of mine, and I go through directors' filmographies, film by film, and drive each other mad, wrestling with their status as quote-unquote blank check filmmakers and the passion projects they sometimes are allowed to create. And it's fun. Allison's been on it.
I have been on it.
And it's a great time.
And we talked about The Prestige.
We did. It's a good episode. good movie. We're on,
all the places.
You can find a podcast.
And if you are in New York City and you are pining for an IRL glimpse of Matt Singer, he will be leaving The Newborn Behind for an evening to appear in a one-night-only special as part of the Brooklyn Podcast Festival on Saturday, November 18th at 10 p.m. I will be in Key West that weekend. Mm. It's a hard life.
Yeah,
I'm very sorry. But Matt will have some excellent company in Dan McCoy and Stuart Wellington of the Flophouse podcast. Yes, for the first and maybe last time ever, it will be Flop Spotting SVU.
Great.
Yes.
That's great.
So that's at Union Hall in Brooklyn. You can buy tickets for the event at the Union Hall website. And of course, our website is filmspottingsvu.com. You can find episode archives there, as well as links to all of the titles we discuss on the show. Our remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. Listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.bandcamp.com. And I will be back in 2 weeks with more recommendations and hopefully another guest host, because it would be really sad if I just had to sit here talking to myself. In the meantime, you can find me on Twitter at Allison Wilmore. David is on Twitter at David L. Sims. The show is on Twitter at FilmSpottingSVU. For FilmSpottingSVU, I'm Allison Wilmore.
I'm David Sims.
Thanks for listening.